is that the top of the nitrex, as you may have seen in the previous slide, is open to the surface, and we just covered that with wood chips. And we put these systems in the late fall, and it turns out that the pump chamber after this nitrex filter was pretty stinky after a couple months of operation. And since we put it in the fall, pretty cold weather, we don't know whether any odor was coming off the wood chips or not, if something was coming to the surface. So we might have to put one in the summer to see how that goes. The next system is from Kansas, and this is a very compact system. All that's involved is the septic tank, this unit, pump chamber, and drain field, so it's pretty comparable to a pressure distribution system again. The unit itself sits in the second compartment of a 1,500-gallon septic tank. It's 500 gallons up front. They don't even call it a septic tank, they call it a trash tank. They're just hoping to get the big stuff out, send the rest of it through with very minimal settling. And then this is basically a coffee percolator. There's a blower, it blows air through the effluent, and it comes down through this honeycomb material here. And that's the matrix on which the bugs grow to get all the goodies out of the effluent. This just shows it's normal septic tank, and there's for scale. And this is a very very compact system, and it's one of the cheapest systems of all the ones that we've looked at so far. What we don't know is how much the electricity costs are going to be given the recent issues with.
So does it circulate constantly?
Constantly. The blower's going constantly. And we thought that would be an issue, having the noise from the blower with the houses, but actually we've got one of these installed. We're going to install another two in a couple months, and the homeowner is not commented about the blower at all. She was worried about it too, but it's not been an issue.
What happens if there's a power failure? Does it? Can you just turn it back on
it
again?
It stops, and you just push a button, it starts up again.
And it doesn't interrupt the actual functioning of it, or?
Well, it just goes quiescent for a while. It becomes a normal septic tank. But the thing is that they'll have to watch out for is that if there's a pump after this system, you know, like a pressure distribution system, then they'll have to realize that if there's no electricity, the pump isn't functioning either. And so they'll have to cut way back on their sewer use in order to avoid having stuff back up because it's not getting pumped to the drain field. So that's one issue we haven't had to deal with yet on this property. One of the German units, the power did go out twice on it, and they just pushed the button. It started right up again, and no apparent difficulties.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krieger.
You mentioned it was low cost. What is the cost of a unit?
This system installed, the total installation cost was about $7,500. The German unit was about $10,000 installed minus shipping. Shipping was an additional $6,000 because it came from Germany. The Orenco systems was $15,000 installed. The Nitrex was $14,000 installed, but just keep in mind the majority of that was that sand filter. So
oops, you had it and then it lost. Oh,
there it goes. And then the final system that I'll show you was $18,000 installed. And this is the last one. This one we haven't installed any yet. We're going to in a month install three of these systems. And this is a very complex system. It's basically a package treatment plant. Arrives complete on your lot and you dig a big hole for it. And we're going to test drip irrigation on this because the effluent quality is supposed to be very high quality, almost drinking water quality. And this gives you a picture of the unit itself. It's very complex. There's actually four chambers here, which you can't see very well. This is the settling chamber right there. And down here is a little solids pump. There's no way to pump this first chamber. And what they do is they take the solids out of here, take it up here to what I call the Easy Bake Oven. It's a very relatively low temperature thermal processor that bakes the sludge into ash, and then it it sends the ash back through the system as suspended solids, so there's presumably no, you never have to pump this thing. We'll see.
I'm sure that's going to take a lot of heat, doesn't it?
Actually, no, it only goes up to 400 degrees, and the thing is buried up to here in the ground, so there's a lot of
insulation
and the like, so.
Do you have any figures on energy consumption?
They estimated, using California electricity rates a year ago, $18 a month. We'll see what it is now. double or triple that or whatever you want. So.
So what happens in the rest of this thing?
And this is these little, goodness. These little things here are little plastic, I don't know what you call it, pieces that are bobbing around. They're very convoluted in shape, and so the bacteria grow on these pieces, and that's the aerobic treatment. So it goes to here, settling. Here's aerobic treatment. You get the nitrification. This is a denitrification, an anaerobic environment. So that's where the denitrification is taking place. The nutrients are getting taken out. And then this is a clarification pump basin. So there's a blower comes in here, and then this is a chlorine. You can add chlorine for disinfection if you so choose. We're not going to use the chlorine to try to avoid introducing additional chlorine into the environment, and we're doing it all subsurface. It's kind of complex, and there's recirculation, and you know, like I said, it's a miniature municipal sewage treatment plant on your property, with the price tag to boot. This one was the $18,000 installed.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
What would be the capacity of a plant like
this? This is rated for 600 gallons per day. So it's a little bigger than what we normally, you know, normally the design flow for a permit is, or for a system is 450 gallons per day, so that ups that a little bit.
Huh, interesting.
So I just want to talk a little bit about our groundwater model. Up to this phase, we've got 2 or 3 years of data collection under our belts for the groundwater model. And what we want to do, like I said before, is figure out how groundwater is flowing. We want to figure out how nitrogen is moving with groundwater, how it is or how it isn't, if that's the case. And so that way we can get an idea of how on-site systems affect groundwater and estimate how many, you know, potential nitrogen loading. You know, look at how development will impact nitrogen in the groundwater over the long term. And so, like I said, we've done a lot of data collection to date. We do twice a year, we do big, what we call synoptic samplings, which are all of domestic wells. These are all drinking water wells. People have volunteered to be a part of the study. And then the USGS has also installed a lot of different monitoring wells to get their own data in terms of pharmaceuticals or isolating plumes. So what have we learned? Well, first, we've learned that we're not picking up a lot of nitrate in domestic wells, which is good, because originally we're thinking we'd start picking up a whole lot more by now. The original study was done in the early 90s. We had a two-dimensional model completed in 95 that showed some pretty glaring hot spots. And what the data collection has done to date is it's confirmed that those hot spots are there, but they're not nearly as big as we thought they were. So that makes us feel a little better. They're also not growing as much as we thought they were. And we're finding that the most nitrogen is in the upper levels of the water table, not down deeper where the drinking water wells are drawing from. And what that tells us is that the groundwater is actually moving much slower than we thought it was. Originally, we were thinking the groundwater was moving on the order of, you know, years to get down through the upper part of the water table to the drinking water wells, which what we're actually finding, it's taking decades. And so we're not seeing the nitrogen in the domestic wells, but it's kind of, we're not seeing it yet, because those domestic wells are typically around 20, 30, 40 feet down. Well, that's probably 20, 30, 40 years down. And so what we're seeing is, where we are seeing nitrogen is where the very early impacts of development are being seen. And so we're not seeing yet what the impacts of all the development since then is yet. We're also finding that there's very oxygenated water at the top, there's some very anoxic water or oxygen poor water below that. And there's an interesting, we found out it's great because once the effluent would hit that non-oxygenated water, then the nitrate problem is pretty well taken care of on its own. So we just have to be concerned about those upper levels where there is oxygen, then the nitrates will perpetuate themselves through the system until they're otherwise taken care of. And we have found some natural sources of nitrogen. There's some deep buried forests in the area that we're picking up ammonia from. We're also getting some impacts from livestock and dogs. So. And just a little bit on the maintenance program. The approach we're taking to this is that there's been a lot of study in the area looking at centralized sewer. Well, if we have such a huge problem, why don't we just sewer the area? Well, we run into goal 11. We also run into the issue that it's just too expensive to sewer that whole area. You know, these are half acre to an acre in size, all these lots, and to sewer these is way more expensive than it is to serve them all with on-site. But the problem with on-site is that we need to make sure they're maintained appropriately for the long term. Most of these systems have a design life of at least 20 years. Most of them probably are not seeing that design life because they're not maintained. You know, the pumps need to be checked, screens need to be cleaned, laterals cleaned, and all that. So what we're doing in this task is we've set together a working group to lay out what the plan for maintenance for the long term in the South County is going to be. And in the process, they're going to develop a series of options that could be translated to statewide use. We're also doing a pretty heavy education campaign in the area because a lot of folks saying, well, I never knew that about on-site systems when they move here or move to Deschutes County. And so we're educating the public. We're also targeting specific professional groups. We did a really good session with the realtors, the Central Oregon Association of Realtors, and they loved it. We did the ABCs of on-site, told them what a septic tank was and what it was supposed to do, told them what a drain field was and what it was supposed to do. Most of them thought the system ended with the septic tank. And so that was very well received. One of the comments was, this should be required for all realtors. And so what we're going to do is take that presentation and repackage it for general use and try to ship that statewide also. The last thing that we'd like to do with the maintenance program is review state and local regulations to see if there are any kind of institutional barriers to getting a program established or underway. Obviously, that'll be down the road a little bit after the working group has worked for a while. And finally, we're going to be working on a low-interest loan program to see if we can replace some of those failing or poorly located systems with either some of these experimental systems or something better, like a sand filter that would work better in the location. And I just want to give credit where credit is due. That's our project team. So thank you very much for having me.
Questions? Representative Pete?
A couple of questions. Now, in La Pine, how is that identified? A rural residential, the build-up area where the commercial is done? What do you call that?
It's rural residential.
Rural residential. It has no central sewer system.
Caveat. I mean, this is called the La Pine Demonstration Project.
Yeah.
The La Pine core area is sewered. So that's the urban unincorporated community of La Pine is sewered. The larger South County area is rural residential, RR10.
Okay, so in the commercial center of La Pine, it is sewered there. And is it out from there at all, or just that area?
Just that area, yeah.
If it takes, if the people are drawing from what are pretty shallow wells, in my experience, 30 or 40 feet, you can almost hand dig one of those. Why couldn't you, if you needed to do it, why couldn't they just case the wells down to 100 feet if it takes 50 years for the water to trickle down there?
That's a potential. The problem is the deeper you go in the groundwater for drinking, the worse the water quality gets, because we get into more iron, high sulfur, and so you start getting into very expensive water treatment systems.
Okay, one last question, then, Chair. But if it's taking 25 or 30 years to trickle down to the 30-foot level, I thought water purified itself in a fairly short time when it was trickling through soil or even in a stream bed. Wouldn't that water be clean by the time it got down there?
The problem is that the effluent comes out of the septic tank being very oxygen poor, and so all of the nitrogen that's in that effluent is in the form of ammonia. Once you start trickling it through the soil, you start adding air to the system, and all the ammonia gets transferred into nitrates. And the ammonia isn't so much of a health issue, but once it's turned into nitrates and the nitrates get into the groundwater, they stay there. And the nitrates, you know, once you get to certain levels, they can start calling, can't say the huge long name of it, but it's the blue baby syndrome, where if your immune system is compromised or you don't have a good circulatory system, then your system has a very hard time transferring oxygen. Your hemoglobin can't work as well as it did. And the nitrates, once they hit the groundwater, they're very conservative. They do not transform themselves unless there's a change, all of a sudden the groundwater becomes oxygen poor for some reason. So that's why it's an issue, because the top 100 feet or whatever of the groundwater, you know, I don't know an exact figure, is oxygen rich. And it's not until you get into the much deeper areas with the poor groundwater quality for drinking, in terms of aesthetics, that you get the denitrification occurring naturally.
Well, one follow-up question. Well, you seem to mention a fairly exotic disease. Are there other health hazards other than the one that you mentioned?
Well, it's not that exotic. If you get a high enough level of nitrogen or nitrate input to your system, it's you know, if you have children or you have elderly or you have otherwise health impaired persons, it's a pretty significant hit to the body. Otherwise, you know, the one thing that we don't know is how well viruses and other pathogens are carried along with that, and nitrate could be used as a marker for those kinds of contaminants.
Thank you.
Questions, comments? Senator Ferrioli.
The news that the Deschutes Aquifer and the nitrate problem is possibly less serious than we'd earlier been advised, and we've been following this thing for 10 years now, but there's a Deschutes Aquifer Working Group that does reports quarterly on this issue and meets at least quarterly. That's great news, and it's good to hear that. The fact that there's a natural remediation system with an anaerobic process for neutralizing nitrates is great news. What isn't so good, I think, is the conclusion by the agency that they don't need to look at a technological application of currently available systems in those places where they're clearly necessary. Because although the good news is good, it's not universally good. There's some places where there's clear hot nitrate plumes and pollution potentials, and for that the answer is not universal applications of a septic district, but certainly in areas it should be clear that the indications for septic districts. And, you know, the state has the mechanisms for bonding the applications for landowners, providing some financial support, technical administration, technical assistance grants for design. It's a human health problem, and it's a public health problem, and it's identifiable, and it's clear and present. But what will stop the application of all of that solution is goal 11. You know, that we would not use an urban level of services in a rural area. Now, I will submit for your consideration that all of the environmental effects of the developed properties has already been felt. They're developed. The undeveloped properties are a different matter, and to allow more septic systems to go into an area that's already arguably 30 or 40 years or 50 years away from a serious nitrate pollution problem is not very defensible. And I suppose I'm overly sensitive to this issue. I just have come from a two-day meeting at the Hanford Nuclear Waste Board. Oregon has a group of citizens and legislators that meet quarterly to discuss Oregon's role in supporting the Hanford Nuclear Reservation cleanup issues. And this may be some of the echoes of the discussion I'm sure that happened at Hanford when they said, well, you know, this is the desert and it's probably never going to get built up and we'll just pump 450 billion gallons of nuclear contaminated water right into the groundwater system, which we did do over a 50-year period. I can't compare these two things in scale. You just can't. But let's not fool ourselves. Goal 11 is and will continue to prevent the application of currently available technology to solve human health problems that are clear and present. And I just think the agency ought to stand up and say, listen, you know, there ought to be some exceptions to Goal 11 when you've got nitrate pollution coming from development and you've got arguably 50% of the lots out there are lots of record and developable. We're going to add more people out there. We should use at least selective applications of septic districts to solve the water pollution problem. That's my sermon for the day.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Morgan. I've heard of a system called the BAT, B-A-T. It's kind of strange. I just got a whole pamphlet on it yesterday in the mail from a guy I met at Brookings in July, and it just happened to get here yesterday. I'll have to bring it, copies of it down. It's a similar type system that he said he'd used in California. Wasn't approved in Oregon, but they're using them all over down there. I'll bring a copy of it.
How did you choose what is included in the project? Did you just include everyone that applied to the process?
Madam Chair, no, we did not. We had a series of criteria for selecting the systems that were included in the project, and those included pretty strict water or effluent quality criteria. They had to meet be less than or equal to 10 TSS, 10 BOD, 10 nitrogen, and they had to have 2 to 3 order magnitude reduction in fecal in E. coli bacteria. So these criteria are a little stricter than a lot of other areas or other states may look at in terms of a on-site sewage disposal system. And so a lot of the companies actually had difficulties meeting the burden of proof, if you will, for showing that their system meets those criteria. We had to have, we required that they have third-party data showing that they met the standards that we wanted them to meet.
How do those standards compare with, say, a sand filter system?
Standard sand filter does very well on the TSS, you know, the total suspended solids. It doesn't do so well on the BOD or the nitrogen. It reduces the nitrogen in the wastewater about half what a standard system would do. And that's on the order of 20 to 30 milligrams per liter, and we're looking for 10 or less milligrams per liter of nitrogen.
So you're looking for systems that will substantially decrease the nitrogen below those levels. Mm-hmm. How long is the project, this demonstration project, going to be going before you reach some kind of conclusions that you put into practice?
The project itself, the whole demonstration project, has a 5-year lifespan. The experimental systems portion of the project is 3 years. What we're going to do, 3 years for each system. And what we're going to do is monitor each individual system intensively for a year. We sample them monthly for a year. And then after that, we go back to every 2-month sampling.
And when you say sampling, you're sampling around the...
We're sampling each component of the system, and then we're sampling the groundwater around it.
And then when you finished with these 3-year sampling periods, what are you going to do with the data? What's the next stage?
The next stage is make a recommendation as to whether or not these systems should be approved for general use in Oregon.
And that would go to the EQC? Is that where that ends up?
Madam Chair, I'll check. I don't think it needs to go that far. I think the department can just make a decision. We might have to make a rule change. I'll check and see. But I think that that's just a department action.
And then it would just be added to the list of tools that would be in the toolbox to be applied in specified situations?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the low interest loan program. I know that I've had some discussions with folks in the agency about trying to set up some mechanisms for that. Have you got any funding sources for that?
Why don't you answer on the project, and then I'll respond more broadly.
Madam Chair, the project has a $1 million line item for the low-interest loan program. So that would be that there's most of it is going to go to loans, and then there would be a small amount of administrative dollars associated with that. The exact mechanism of how that would be transmitted to a loan holder or a loan recipient is not defined yet.
And Madam Chair, I would add, and unless Helen can give it to me, I don't have the bill number, but the department has a bill in this session that would expand the use of the state revolving fund that is currently for the upgrade of municipal sewage treatment plants, would expand the use of that loan eligibility for on-site systems and perhaps some other non-point source activity as well.
Representative Hayden.
Well, is the on-the-ground application of this then that if a citizen has a lot, they want to build on it, the county says, yeah, you can build, but it's, sorry, there's no place for a septic tank. Then we could use one of these, and the county would have authority to grant the building permit based on the fact that the DEQ had approved an alternative kind of septic system. Is that where we're going?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that's the hope, that this would certainly have broader application than just the Lapine area. That the high groundwater table is not unique to just the Lapine area. There are other parts of the state, particularly along the coast, where we have had problems with pieces of property, either because of the size of the property or the depth of groundwater or whatever, where the systems that are traditionally available just can't handle it, and that potentially some of these systems might be able to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, well, not just groundwater, but soil types and so on, all the things that the county planners deal with. But, and I guess another policy thing, not dealing specifically with your project, but Senator Ferrioli's concept, it just seems much more prudent and appropriate where you do have a large concentration of lots where people want to build to let them put in a central sewer system. And what would the legislature have to do to make that happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I am not an expert on Goal 11, and that would be a question for DLCD. However, I do know that we have continuous and many dialogues with DLCD on this very issue. It is an issue of concern for us, and I think in some cases you're absolutely correct. And there is a tension between the land use laws and what might be a practical solution to a sewage problem.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I want to explore a little bit more the practical application of these systems, and they appear to be, for situations such as what you said, where you have a high water level and you need to be real mindful of the nitrogen levels that you're letting out of the system, but they don't appear to have applicability in situations where, for instance, it's a small lot. I mean, they all seem to be basically sand filter systems with another piece attached to them somehow. Can you talk about what other situations they would help besides the high water table situation?
Madam Chair, I should clarify. When I said that most of these systems were approximately the same as a pressure distribution, I neglected to mention that the drain field is actually shorter. It's 100. We have 100-foot drain fields on all of these, except for the pressure or the pardon me the drip irrigation system, which will be slightly larger. But so the drain field area is actually smaller because we do have higher effluent quality. And so the area, the actual area of the disposal area is what we're concerned with, and that is substantially smaller than the experimental systems.
Okay. Questions, comments, Senator?
We're working on some other alternatives too, including transferable development rights. In other words, there are some places that, because of high water table and the goal 11 and some other considerations, it's just they are not suitable for development. If they were not lots of record that have grandfather development rights, then literally people who have owned the property for years, sometimes decades, could go to a county or a county building authority and not find approval in that process. I think Representative Hayden has referred to this frequently in the hearing room, at least, and probably more frequently in private. That mechanism has not been demonstrated to be effective yet. I don't know of anywhere where we've got transferable development rights in place. We've created a mechanism in a couple of places, but we haven't really seen much of that action yet. But it shows that Department of Environmental Quality and some of the other agencies, especially LCDC, need to interface and come up with solutions that are the least intrusive solutions to the landowner and property owner. And I guess I'll just reiterate, I don't think the agency does its duty to the citizens by deferring to an LCDC goal that keeps us from using the best available technology to solve environmental problems. We shouldn't fear technology or shun technology when we've got a problem that cries out for a solution, and we're constrained from making the application of the solution by somebody's interpretation of one of the land use planning goals in Oregon.
And I think that that is an issue that's caused a great many of us legislatively and in agencies a lot of frustration. And hopefully we'll be in a place where we can address it legislatively and get the issue all the way through the system at some point in time.
Well, I'd like to also put this series of projects in perspective. I think this agency is looking for solutions that would have application in that circumstance. The problem and the question that's unanswered is that we don't know if this agency's work will ever be applied on the ground because of Goal 11. Somebody may allege that engineering a system for a specific site is an urban level of services. So, I mean, I guess 11 is meant to protect the Oregonians from urban sprawl and the spread of very expensive urban level of technology, roads, sewer systems, power lines, et cetera, out into unimproved areas. But where you've got a population center that's arguably denser than you'll find in much of rural Oregon, and people already living there using these systems, not to recognize that the impacts are already felt by the environment and that part of the environment is degraded, means that we're essentially allowing it to continue and increase rather than stopping it with a technological solution, even though population would increase in the area, because it will anyway. So I guess we're caught in that conundrum between protecting the environment and protecting the rights of citizens and landowners. I say that this is a public health question more than a land use issue. It's 50 years from now, even though we found out that the water migrates more slowly than we thought. At one point, people were saying that snow melt in the east side of the Cascades was ending up as groundwater in the Deschutes Aquifer in as little as 18 months. You know? You'd love to comment on that, I know.
Yeah, I do. Madam Chair and Senator Farioli, that may actually be true, because there's a difference between precipitation getting to the top of the water table versus water moving through the aquifer. Water hitting the surface of the ground and moving through the soil column moves very, very quickly. You know, we see seasonal changes due to that precipitation, but actually moving through the water table itself, it's moving very, very slowly. So that's where the difference there is.
And Madam Chairman, I believe that whether or not this is upwelling or infusion or transmogrification, when people get sick, we're the ones that are responsible. We have a technical solution. We ought to allow it and encourage it.
I have one more thing that I want to nail down before we leave this, and I'm not real clear on how far into this we are, so I'm not clear when we're going to have some actual results.
Madam Chair, we put the first systems, the Urenco systems were the first systems to go in the ground, and they went in the middle of September of 2000. So we're just in the first 6 months of operation for most of these systems, so we have the majority of work ahead of us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Krieger.
How many people are involved in the program at La Pine?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger. In terms of property owners?
No, staff, DEQ people.
DEQ staff, we have a total of 4. Deschutes County staff, we have 3. And USGS staff, we have 2.
Representative Hayden.
Yeah, just a couple of more questions and comments. If there are systems that are capable of processing the effluent to drinking water standards, and if you had a system like that, would you even need a drain field, or would you just drain directly into a water course?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the on-site rules currently require that we dispose of effluent from on-site systems underground. And so we have that sort of barrier to using the water otherwise. But that does not prohibit us from using something like a drip irrigation system for, you know, a person's garden or what have you. So there's the potential, yes, it may meet drinking water standards, and there may be a conflict between our existing rules, but that doesn't necessarily preclude us from having a beneficial reuse of the effluent. Certainly, some people might prefer to create a pond, but then we'd have to look at changing our rules.
And one other question, Madam Chair. Would this be too simplistic a solution that you take an area like La Pine, and because of the Goal 11, we can't provide a sewer system because it's not a city? Just making it a city, just incorporate it, and then...
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the citizens of La Pine have already looked at that, and they voted down incorporation 3-1.
But question is, would this solve the problem? If we had a rural area that had enough lots to support or was capable of being developed, platted and developed into a city, can we just avoid the whole hassle by saying, boom, you're a city? Do it.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, sure, it would solve the problem in a perfect world and with infinite resources. But the regional problem-solving project did study the issue of sewering the area, and it was too expensive. I don't remember the figures, but it was just, you know, even the citizens of La Pine who were, you know, faced with having a lot that was undevelopable couldn't stomach the thought of that high a cost for providing sewer and or water service to the lots. And in light of just declining federal assistance for sewering areas like that, it wasn't feasible when they studied it.
Madam Chair, I'd like to add to that, because this, we've focused here on the on-site system aspect of this. The La Pine demonstration project was a huge multi-dimensional activity that started with the land use issues in regional problem solving. And there was, I think, a real desire on the part of if not all of the county commissioners, at least at one time, most of the county commissioners in Deschutes County of the state, to try and have La Pine become a city. And so there was a lot of effort expended in that direction, and it just, the political will wasn't there to make it happen. But you're quite correct that other solutions would have been available if they had chosen to be a city.
Okay. I have an urban unincorporated area in my district called Merlin that's north of Grants Pass, and we had much the same issues with that, where they have a lot of problems with failing septic systems, and saw the solution as incorporating and putting in a step system, and weren't able to politically move it to the stage where they could get enough people to agree to the incorporation. So again, it's a problem with the Goal 11 crossovers not allowing urban levels of services outside of areas that don't have urban districts formed.
Well, Madam Chair, would the people be as willing to pay for a sewer if they were unincorporated as if they were incorporated? What would the difference be?
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, that issue would be, I don't know if that was explored on that basis.
Madam Chair, I just want to add one thing for the committee. It's House Bill 2149 that has the would allow state revolving funds to be used for funding on-site systems.
Certainly in an area like I think a number of us represent, there are problems in those districts with septic systems that are failing or for whatever reason are contributing to problems with water quality, and the people just can't afford to fix them. And I've run into that in several instances in my legislative district, and there really isn't at this point anywhere that those people can go to get into a program that will help them be able to afford to replace the systems.
Madam Chair, this isn't just a kind of a rural residential area, a rural residential problem, although the Portland metropolitan area is pretty much past that now, but during the 70s and 80s, we had horrendous problems in mid-Multnomah County. The Loa area went through that same issue of making a decision whether to incorporate or not incorporate. Mid-County area, although certainly by rural standards, it'd be very densely populated. When that area was sewered, there were still a lot of very sizable lots and a lot of property that had 2-acre building sites, sometimes on corners. And the cost for sewering that was just an incredible burden to the people that lived there. And then probably the only thing that saved it was the fact that because it was an urban area, of that level of, by putting the sewer system in, then you could get a great deal more development. That new development then would help to pay for the sewering. But especially if you've got an area that really can't handle a high densification, then there's not another wave of people coming along to help pay for the cost. If somebody gets hit with a $70,000 or $80,000 sewer assessment in the mid-county area, they can subdivide, or there's other options for them. But if you didn't have that option, the sewer prices would be a huge burden.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the comments Representative Hansen has made about that project. And I have to clarify a few things since I was the Director of Environmental Services and on the firing line on many public hearings as a result of that procedure. There were expensive assessments to property owners for that project, but the project was also specifically subsidized by all ratepayers within the city of Portland in order to assist particularly low-income people in that area. And I raise that point both to clarify the record and to bring it back to some of the other discussions we have had about the burden of environmental cleanups. Every sewer ratepayer within the city of Portland paid to clean up the mid-county area, even property owners who had themselves paid for the cost of the installation of the sewer serving their property. So there have been other ways that Portlanders have taken care of their own.
Thank you. Further questions? Well, thank you very much, Ms. Rich, for making the trip over the mountains to the Willamette Valley. We appreciate you doing that and bringing the presentation to us. And what we'll do now, Representative Hayden has requested that we take a little 5-minute break in between the sections so we can kind of stretch our legs and get set up for the next one. Let's move next and finish up the waste management and cleanup section.
All right, Madam Chair, I also have some follow-up for you from some of the questions.
the meeting here and take up the, in the Waste Management and Cleanup Division program where we left off yesterday. And I will just turn it over to your capable hands.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things before we start. First of all, I need to correct something that was handed out yesterday and apologize to Representative Nolan and Representative Hansen. The sewage spill from the city of Portland, the volume of the spill from the city of Portland was 2.5 million gallons. It was not 22.5. There was a typo on the handout, and there's a significant difference there, and I wanted to correct that for you. And I also wanted to go over just briefly the handout that Ken just gave you. You had asked about customer service surveys that we have done, and we went back and checked. We did do a survey of our what we refer to our external customers, primarily the regulated community, in 1994, and followed that up with some focus groups in 1995. That was right at the time that we were transitioning to the decentralized organization. And the intent was then, after a period of time, to go back and re-survey to see whether or not the decentralization had had a positive impact, which we hoped it would have. That re-surveying has not yet been done. We also did a customer service survey specifically in 1996 in the vehicle inspection program. And then in March of last year, it partially in response to the directives on the cleanup program from this last legislative session, the cleanup program has done a customer service survey. I think it is something we should do to follow up on, particularly to follow up on the fact that we've been decentralized for quite a while now, which was in theory supposed to improve service in some respects and responsiveness. Those surveys, when we did the one in 94, I think it cost around $50,000. In today's dollars, it would probably be up around 75 or so, and obviously we'd need to look at that in terms of budget priorities. The other thing in this handout is a summary. You had asked yesterday for FTE in the Waste Management Cleanup Program, and this is a summary chart just of this division, not all the divisions at DEQ, and it shows FTE in headquarters, regions, and the laboratory. Also, Mr. Rocco has asked for very detailed information on all the staff in the agency, which would be quite a thick document, as you can imagine, but we are getting that to him, and that will, of course, be available to the committee if you want that kind of specific information.
And what I think that I'm probably more interested in what's coming for Mr. Rocco, what I'm really interested in doing is trying to get a picture of how each of the programs are organized in how many people are in management, how many staff people are assistants to managers, who the report tos are, what the functions of the report, the people that are reporting to the managers are. I'm just trying to get a more detailed picture of how the program is organized and how many people are in it, and kind of not necessarily a real detailed look at what they do, although I think Mr. Rocco is interested in that aspect, but just basically a picture of how it's all wired together.
Okay. Madam Chair, you will get that. My only concern about that document is that you not be overwhelmed by it, and if there are any ways that we can sort or reshuffle or somehow provide the information so it's not just this huge pile of pages of org charts. The basic structure is, I know it doesn't sound like it, but it is relatively simple. I mean, we have our headquarters that is in Portland, and we have our three geographic regions, and we have a laboratory. I mean, that's basically it. Within those three geographic regions, we have field offices, 16 field offices. And the management structure is, we have the director's office, and we have our management services and headquarters, which is the infrastructure support. And then we have the air, water, and waste programs, basically. And those have a headquarters unit that does policy and program development, and then they each have field functions. They have air field functions throughout the state, and water field functions throughout the state, and waste field functions throughout the state, as well as at the laboratory. The laboratory is also located in Portland. So you have a headquarters, policy program development, and then you have field policy program implementation. I mean, the theory of it is pretty straightforward. And so when you walk into a field office, what you would see in a larger field office, the one I'm most familiar with is Bend because I was there, you would have all the programs represented in that field office in Bend to do field work, to get the permits out right there without them necessarily having to come back to Portland to get a permit, that sort of thing. So the idea is policy development centralized in headquarters, policy program implementation decentralized in the field. And that's the concept behind the structure.
Okay, and then this is way off of where we're at right now, but the other part of this that's really difficult for me to get my hands around is that the physical structure is decentralized, but the accounting structure doesn't reflect that.
Madam Chair, that is correct, and the piece that it doesn't reflect, it partly reflects it. Our program budgets have always been laid out by program, air, water, and waste. And so when we decentralized the agency, we kept those program delineations, air, water, and waste, agency management, and the Office of the Director, but they weren't all in Portland anymore. They were out through the state. So you'd still have the water budget, and you'd have, well, I'll use this waste one. This is a good example. Take environmental cleanup. Take the whole agency because it's waste prevention and management. You have a total 251.28 FTE in the lower right-hand corner. And the budget includes all of these organizational units that you see on this chart. So you have a budget for waste and cleanup, and it includes a headquarters component. It includes a Northwest region, Western, Eastern, lab, etc. I mean, but it's organized by program. So, and then water has one like that, and air has one like that. That is different than having, stop me if you don't want me to go into all of this, because I don't want to confuse you. So it's all programs, statewide budget. The way it could be that it isn't is you could say, okay, we're going to have a multimedia budget. We could have a Northwest region or an Eastern region DEQ or a Western region. We could budget by region. We didn't do that. We kept the budget on program lines that had always been on program lines, and we thought it would just be too confusing for everyone, this body included. I mean, they've always dealt with DEQ, air, water, waste. So we didn't change. We kept the program all throughout the state budgeted like that. Where internally to us we get into conflict is if a particular region wants to focus on some kind of program aspect that maybe that program doesn't allow for, then we have to resolve that tension kind of between the field office and headquarters if they want more money for a particular function. But it's really an operational issue rather than a budget issue. It generally works pretty well. And it does have a single point of accountability for the budget for that program. And each program has in the budget office, they have like a water budget person and an air budget person and a waste budget person who works in the budget shop for the budget manager and manages the budget for each of those programs. Now there are little sub-programs, like you've seen in waste, there's a waste budget and then you'll have some tanks budget in there and you'll have some solid waste and you'll have some hazardous waste, but it's all within the waste cleanup division budget, and that budget analyst assigned to that division takes care of that budget for all those functions. And same with air and same with water.
Well, and I think we're going to get into kind of a global discussion to this when we get into the administrative part of the agency.
Yes.
But it is, there are some things that I want to explore when we get okay. to that point about the difficulty of a committee like this getting a handle on how the actually how the funding is applied within the agency.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and I just would add a couple things. One is the funding is pretty straightforward in that within what we refer to those silos of air, water, and waste, the funds that go to those silos go just to those silos with the exception of general fund. General fund is the only revenue source that is fungible, can be moved from one silo to another. But the federal dollars are earmarked air, water, waste. The fees are earmarked air, water, waste. So there is some movement within those programs. You may have some fee dollars like in the air program that there is some fungibility or in water or in waste, but they can't go this way. The only revenue source that can go this way is general fund.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, we better get back on track.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But that was very interesting.
Okay. Where we left off yesterday was in the policy option packages, tab 6 of your binder, page 74, Waste Management Cleanup Division Policy Packages. Yesterday I had discussed the policy package for orphan site cleanup, marine oil spill preparedness, and I was just to begin speaking about policy package for heating oil tanks, which is policy package 132. That's found on page 422 of your big budget book. And it is also House Bill 2883, which is three pages behind, it's on page 77, I believe, a summary of that House bill. That House bill is, where is it? I don't know where it is. What committee is that House bill in?
It hasn't been, but all right. It hasn't come up yet.
Okay, that bill has not yet come up. Anyway, this policy package is intended to go with that legislation. As I said, it's policy package number 132. It is a $244,000 to be raised from a fee increase, and it would fund 1.5 FTE that had been funded by general fund, and that general fund is going away, and so there's a proposal to increase the registration fee for heating oil tanks to retain that FTE, and that's what that policy package is all about. And I talked, when I did the program overview, I went into a fair amount of detail about the heating oil tank program. I can cover that again, or we can just move on.
Questions, comments?
Oh, just to recapitulate that we were dismayed to hear that this huge, enormous, expensive program that we'd implemented for new tanks, that the tanks are leaking. And we wonder who bears the onus for that. Is it the manufacturer or the installer or the state? I don't think it should be the customer, the citizen.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, we did indeed have that conversation, and that conversation was about the other piece of this program. That conversation was with regard to the underground storage tank, petroleum tanks, the gas stations, and we are coming back to you with a detailed description of what we found. This package refers to homeowners, individual homeowners who in the past heated their homes with oil heat. They have since converted or for other reasons shut down those home heating oil tanks. And this program is designed to assist in property transfers. That's really why it came to be a couple of biennia ago, was the need to, when these homes are sold, to make sure that those tanks are decommissioned properly. So there are two separate aspects to the program.
So we're on page 74, and we're talking about 132 and 130.
I'm just to go to 130. That's the next one. Right now, I was just talking about 132.
Okay.
And we will be getting back to you with that information that you asked for yesterday on the underground tanks.
With regard to the heating oil tanks, there is, I believe, a loop in that program where people can remove their own tanks.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Sally Pant to, and I neglected to introduce these folks again, so I'll have them introduce themselves to you.
Can you describe the mechanics of that program and approximately what it costs people to complete it?
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Sally Pant, and I'm the Acting Division Administrator of Waste Prevention and Management. And Madam Chair, there is a component whereby homeowners can decommission their own tanks. We've provided some technical assistance and information for them on how to proceed with that. I'm not exactly sure. And I could get that information for you on the costs. We're finding that homeowners who are decommissioning heating oil tanks that have leaks and working with contractors, that it costs them from around $3,500 to $5,000, depending on the extent of contamination and other circumstances surrounding that decommissioning. I believe, but I will, as I said, get back to you on this. It's running around $1,500, or it is substantially less than going through a contractor. However, it's not always the easiest thing to necessarily do, depending on the problems. If you've had a leak, we really recommend that you probably need some professional help with that. But if you have a tank that hasn't leaked, what we call clean decommissioning, it may well be that a homeowner could perform that on their own.
What's the nature of the technical assistance that the department offers?
Mostly this, excuse me, Chair Morgan, at this point, given the amount of FTE we have in the program, generally it's, we'll be glad to help folks with telephone calls, work them through the process. I believe we have some technical assistance documents. We generally aren't able to make specific inspections in those situations.
Do people buy a permit to be able to do this?
It's a $50 fee. It's a $50 registration fee with the department.
When they've gotten through the program, how can they be assured that they get the sign-offs that they need to do the property transfers? How does that part of it work?
Probably it would be best for me to get back to you on that.
Okay.
I don't believe we've had a lot of these, but we could get back to you on that with the additional information that we're getting from the tank program.
Further questions?
No, you made fun of my last one.
Well, let's move right
ahead. Sheriff, if I might add something, this situation was partially created last session with the passage of House Bill 3107, which included a mixture of general fund for the program and the establishment of this fee on contractors and people that provide the removal of tanks, and I don't believe there was a fee charged against homeowners in that bill. However, the general fund was not brought forward in the budget, in the governor's recommended budget, so because of that there's a gap in the funding to maintain the program level.
Senator Ferriola.
Madam Chairman, in case there's a question, Ms. Pent is in charge of the DEQ's Homeowner Lest program.
Homeowner Lest program?
That's right.
Leaking
underground storage tanks for homeowners. In this case, it's heating. It's fuel oil. But we had a commercial Lest program for gas tanks and oil tanks that were buried, leaking underground storage tanks. This is the homeowner's version for heating oil. But anyone should ask you. It is Ms. Pint who's in charge of the homeowner lust program for the EQ. You can refer them to her.
Okay. I think we better move on to underground storage tanks before we get into big trouble here.
Madam Chair, I want to clarify one thing on what we're going to get back to you on, and that is how we certify or how we otherwise validate when an individual homeowner does their own cleanup. Because the process is pretty clear when there's a contractor involved, there is a pretty clear certification process, but we will get back to you on when the individual homeowner does it. Does that mean we then have to go out and inspect, or what do we do to verify that
and,
work is correct?
And the point of my question, I'm mainly just curious, because with contractors you have people that you can sit down and run through a class and make sure that they understand what the box is that they're working within. But it would be, I think, really difficult to do the same thing with each individual homeowner that came through the process. So I was just curious what the check was at the end of the system and whether they came out of it with the same credential or whatever certificate that someone that had it done professionally would, so that when both of those properties went on the market, it would be... you couldn't tell which one was which from the type of documentation that they had.
I understand your question. We'll definitely find out for you. The next package does, in fact, refer to the underground storage tank program. We talked quite a bit about this yesterday. This is the program that the federal program that we were administering in this state that required the tanks to be decommissioned by December of 1998, and we owe you some information with regard to the survey that we did, where you expressed concern, and rightly so, about the fact that new or modified equipment had been going in and wasn't working properly, and we will get back to you on that. This, and we also discussed yesterday, this is the program where the budget request actually was for a fee that would have fee request that would have doubled the current tank fee. The staff has been working with the stakeholder groups, the petroleum industry and some others, on the fee to continue the compliance program. One particular reason being, as I mentioned, so that we can get full delegation of the federal program, and they've come to a compromise on a fee at $85, which I discussed a little bit yesterday, and I also mentioned to you yesterday the upcoming EPA inspections that will be happening in April of these tanks, and that again is one of the reasons why we would like to continue to have this program and be able to operate it ourselves, and would need that fee increase to keep the staffing levels up to get an approvable EPA program.
Questions or comments?
Okay. We do have two requests in this program that are individual staffing requests. One I've covered in quite a bit of detail, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, and that is for, as I said, both of these folks are acting because we're in essence operating those as separate divisions, particularly since last legislative session when the agency was required to devote a significant amount of time to addressing some problems in the cleanup program, and we focused a lot of management attention on that, on doing that. As I said, Sally has been the acting administrator for the Waste Prevention and Management. And I also indicated some of the history of how those programs were split initially when they were formed, and then when we decentralized, they were reunified, and we figured out over time, as evidenced in some of the problems in the cleanup program, that it was too big a span of control. And so we have requested a position to keep them as separate divisions. The only thing that I would add is that there's no fee increase requested associated with this. We would fund it out of the existing revenues in our programs. The second position is a position I also mentioned briefly, that, and Ken handed out a letter from the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. This is for a solid waste manager position in our Northwest region. Remember I said our programs have a headquarters policy and program development, and then we have three regions, and then there's a program manager in each of those regions for solid waste operations. When we first decentralized the agency, we didn't have enough positions, and so in the west side of the mountains for solid waste, we were one manager short, and we had one manager running all of the solid waste operations on the west side, and we had one on the east side. This request is for a solid waste manager position in the Northwest region, which is our metropolitan Portland area, and it really comes from over time recognizing that the workload was not being managed effectively in that scenario where there was one manager required to manage the permitting and compliance and all the field implementation activities for solid waste on the west side of the mountains. Primarily because there's a pretty large workload in southwestern Oregon, and so the real focus was on that part, and the northwestern Oregon piece of it was getting neglected, quite frankly. And one of the reasons that ORA wrote this letter is they were concerned about some of the, if you will, the level playing field issues, and with the department not really being a solid waste presence in Northwest region as much as they would hope they would be, and being out making sure that recycling facilities are really recycling facilities and that sort of thing. The staff in Northwest region now, I think, is about 8 people. I have to double check. It's 5.5 FTE. And so it's a difficult balance for us. It's not as large a span of control as we would like to see. We generally run about 10 or 11 FTE throughout the department as an average span of control for a section. Some of them are 22, but in this program it's really a question of the program activity and the amount of attention that's being paid to sources and managing all of the solid waste landfill work and all the recycling work for the entire west side of the state, as opposed to breaking it in 2 components as the rest of our programs are.
Why are there more people in the western region?
Because there are, it's a bigger region, and there are more landfill sites in the west. Western region is basically southwestern Oregon, and it's geographically bigger, and there are more active operating facilities in that part of the state, and more issues being addressed. The Northwest region is just really the Tri-County area, and then it goes out to the coast as well, in the north, extreme northwest portion. So that's what that position is all about, and some of the history. And though, I did want to mention, although I didn't list these policy packages in this division, I should have. I talked about them in water quality, as on the water quality side. The waste management and cleanup program is the program from which we shifted. Remember, I gave you the silos, and I said the general fund could go this way. We are proposing to shift general fund from the waste management and cleanup division to the water quality division, and FTE to go with it, to support activities in the water quality program. That is a proposal in this budget for a fund shift. The reason for it is, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, our high priorities in the department are number one, water quality, number two, the toxics program, and that's why some of the fund shifts in air toxics, and then our third priority of engaging Oregonians. This is a proposal that shifts general fund and FTE from the hazardous waste, technical assistance, and compliance activity into water quality. And that is obviously a policy choice and something that you folks are probably going to be interested in discussing as well. But it is proposed in the budget.
Questions or comments?
Okay, those are all the policy packages in this division. The other material in the in this section are the 3 bills that go with the fees that I've discussed. Then there is some supplemental information similar to the other programs, a summary of the macro budget for waste management cleanup, an org chart on the macro level that I recognize doesn't give you what you need, and we're going to get you more, the summary of the budget notes in this program, and a fact sheet on the orphan site program. We talked quite a bit about it, and option package 133. Did I talk about that package? Did I skip
it?
Okay, did yesterday, thank you. And then a fact sheet on McCormick and Baxter, which I mentioned to you was one of the federal Superfund sites, so you could get a picture of how that works.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crowe.
Thank you. Before we leave this particular portion of your presentation, wondered if you could give me an update on the easy drain situation, since that has to do with, in essence, waste management. Where are we at with those folks in terms of trying to satisfy their needs of getting their products certified or even piloted in the state?
Representative Krupp, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that, and Senator Farioli may or may not want to add to this because we've been working with his office on this issue as well. For the rest of the committee, this actually pertains to the presentation that you saw at the beginning of our session. Easy Drain is a company that installs septic tank drain fields, not the actual systems that you saw early on, but the drain field that's connected to that. And they have a drain field is a standard stone trench is a typical septic tank drain field that is common throughout the state. They have a product, a particular media that they would install in lieu of a traditional drain field. And they are in particular competition with another company called Infiltrator Systems, who has a different kind of drain field media. And those, the way the septic tank program works in Oregon, just like these systems that you saw today, that Barbara showed you, that when it is an alternative to a standard drain field, then there's an approval process that they go through with the department. And many years ago, this process started with Easy Drain and Infiltrator, and it has been a long and painful process for all involved, including going to court, and it is still a painful process. Trying to explain where we are in the process. Where we are in the process is that the there are product approvals that are existing for both of those companies in the state of Oregon right now, and those systems are being installed and they are being used. They are also in a demonstration phase for some different aspects to their products, different configurations to the drain field. And they are testing some systems, and they're presenting information to what is called our technical review committee. The department to approve these products establishes a technical review committee of peers, basically, not just department. They includes installers, includes county people, experts in the field of on-site. And so the Easy Drain and Infiltrator folks have presented information to this committee and to the department, and they're in a review and testing mode until December of either this year or next year. I can't remember. I'd have to get back to you on that. So we're still in an ongoing negotiation and discussion. Easy Drain does not feel this process has been fair to them, and we're in continuing dialogues with them. We're also going to be presenting to or providing to Senator Farioli some additional information about where we are in the process, and I'd be happy to give it to the entire committee because there's a lot of detail that I don't know or I don't have at my fingertips right now. I need to get it, but it has been a very, very difficult situation to resolve. It's a question of one or the other company being concerned about competitive advantage, and how the department would resolve that would obviously make a difference, as it might be more expensive or less expensive for one company to install their product.
Because you're requiring them to post a bond, correct?
They're
requiring one company to do that and not the other.
That's Representative Krupp, that is not exactly the case. And I'm in the process of getting briefed myself on the specifics. But this was a rulemaking that was done by our commission that was intended to be an equitable requirement, not a requirement that was applied to one and not applied to another. So I need to get the details. The intention was not to do something inequitable. I need to check on the practical implication or application of it. I want to say one thing about this. I've been affiliated with the on-site program for a long time. I think it is a very bad idea for the Department of Environmental Quality to be in the business of product approval. Whether it is with these folks or the systems you saw today or whatever, I think there are technical, there may be aspects of it that can we can get involved in terms of technical analyses provided to some kind of consumer review board or whatever, but we're not market people. You know, we're an environmental regulatory community or agency, and our job is to protect the environment. And I'm fully sensitive to and appreciate the frustration that some of these people have when they're coming in to registered engineers and sanitarians and whomever to talk about product approval that potentially affects markets. And then we get into these elaborate rulemaking systems to try and be fair, because we are trying to be fair. And I think there's a legitimate question, and I've said this last session, I think to Senator Farioli or somebody else, for somebody sometime to really look at whether or not there's a better way to do this for the state of Oregon, and in which we might play a role. But I'm totally open to that. I'm totally empathetic to the frustration that people have with it, and I would not presume to present us as the very best people to do all aspects of product approval. There are some aspects of it that I think we're very well qualified to do. So maybe I'm asking, maybe I'm just posing a joint problem, but I think it is an issue, and I think it's a legitimate issue. And this case between Infiltrator and Easy Drain, which I've been dealing with for 7 years, it illustrates to me that it is a problem, and it is a problem that we somehow need to fix.
If you didn't, Madam Chair, if I may, if you didn't do it, who would?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Krupp, that's the problem. In trying to solve this Easy Drain Infiltrator problem, one of the things we tried 3 or 4 years ago was a nation to try and put together a national objective group of people who would evaluate these systems for us, and nobody would touch it. They didn't want to get into product liability or somehow getting sued for saying that one product was better than another. So it would probably have to be some legislatively, formally established and endorsed Oregon entity, I would think, maybe with some university people on it. I don't know. We could help define who ought to be on it, so that they would have all the statutory protections that they would need to be able to do their work and not get sued.
Madam Chair, if I may, who, as these products are accepted in other states and so forth, how do other states do it?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I'd like to get back to you on that. There was a time when I knew all that, right. And I'd have to refresh my memory.
Thank you. Appreciate it. That's good.
Well, we've reached the 10-minute mark again. So I think probably this is a good place to break for today. And I'd start out first thing next week with the cross-media program. The members, one thing that has arisen in the last couple of days is when the Water and Environment Committee met last week to take up a memorial that relates to the even application of regulations across the state. One of the issues that came up in the course of that hearing was how the Department of Environmental Quality works through their fines program and how they actually work through the process to levy fines for different situations that come to them as violations. And I asked for a presentation before the Water and Environment Committee that actually involves some examples of fines that were levied. We find in the Water and Environment Committee that we don't have time to hear that presentation. And I asked the chair of the committee if she would be willing to have that transferred to this committee. And so we will be, the department will work with Mr. Rocco on scheduling for next week, but we'll hear that presentation in this committee next week.
Good.
And with that, I will adjourn until Monday.